So our next speaker this afternoon is Kara Santelli from University of Minnesota Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. She'll be speaking about uncovering hidden sulfur biogeochemical cycles in a sulfate-impacted riparian wetland and stream in northeastern Minnesota. Welcome, Kara.
We're ready? Yeah. Okay. Hi, folks. Welcome back. So I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. I've been there about 7 years. I also have an adjunct appointment in the Biotechnology Institute, so I do a lot of applied research as well on bioremediation and other things. And so today I'm going to talk about a project that we just published up in northern Minnesota, Second Creek. Some of you may be familiar with it. And I just want to acknowledge a number of my collaborators on this. Josh Torgerson was a master's student with me, and he graduated a year ago. He's one of the first authors on the paper, along with Carla Rosenfeld, who is a former postdoc in my group and a researcher, as well as Crystal Ng. Some of you might know Crystal. She's a granddaughter, hydrogeologist professor at the University of Minnesota. So those are our primary collaborators on this, but we have a number of other people, Aubrey Dunshi, Kelly Dunn, Riley Schmitter, and Patrick O'Hara. And of course, our wonderful funding sources. The University of Minnesota provided a lot of the funding, as well as the Department of Energy. So this is a picture of Second Creek here. You'll see this a lot. And I'm going to explain this complex diagram and all the biogeochemical cycles that are going on in great detail over the next 20, 25 minutes, 30 minutes or so. Okay. Oops. Let's see. Let's try this. Nope. I'm not a PC user. There we go. Okay. Got it. All right. So a lot of our work is focused on what's happening in the hyperreic zone, and you all here probably think about the hyperreic zone a lot. Maybe some of you do, maybe some of you don't. I'm not exactly sure. But it turns out, it was interesting, because I thought a lot about the hyperreic zone as this, you know, just broadly defined as this area of mixing of surface water with groundwater and underneath, you know, wetlands, streams, lakes. And it turns out if you're a biologist, you define it a little bit differently, and if you're a chemist, you define it a little bit differently. So for my terminology, it's just this area of mixing beneath the wetlands and channels. And we often study what happens in these hyperreic zones kind of, I don't know, siloed in our disciplines. We might study hydrogeology and what's happening with the dynamics of the hydrogeology in these systems, or we might study, say, the ecology of the system, or we might study maybe just like the biogeochemical cycling of what happens in these systems. But what we're trying to do, especially with a collaboration with Crystal and I, is really study these interactions a little more holistically to try to understand, you know, what are the influences of, say, a dynamic surface water, groundwater flux system where you might be changing, say, redox gradients, which might affect biogeochemical cycling, which will affect nutrient transport, contaminant transport, methane emissions, all sorts of things that are happening in these hyperreic zone sediments. Okay, so my group, you know, we focus a lot on these, what's happening, and I'm just going to show you this one study that we showed. So when you set up this, when you have this mixing of the surface water, which is typically rich in oxygen, depleted in things like metals, okay, and you mix it with anoxic, metal-rich groundwater, you set up this really, really nice redox gradient, right? So oxic conditions near the surface to anoxic conditions on the bottom, right? And for those of you that love redox chemistry as much as I do, I think about it all the time. It's so great. It's so wonderful. I was happy to hear it mentioned earlier. But, you know, we think a lot about what's happening in this sediment package in terms of these redox gradients. So reduction, oxidation, what's happening, and how does that influence the chemistry of the waters, the chemistry of the sediments. So in a typical sediment package that you might think about, and you look at the different processes that are happening top to bottom, you would typically expect oxygen, which is the most thermodynamically favorable electron acceptor, right? That's going to react really, really quickly in these systems and be depleted very quickly. So in an organic rich environment, you might expect oxygen to penetrate down only, you know, millimeters to a couple centimeters at most, right? And then as oxygen is depleted, you'll start respiring. And these are all mostly driven by microbial processes, some abiotic processes, but largely driven by biology. You might deplete nitrate next, and eventually you'll start depleting manganese oxides. Deeper down in the sediment, once all these manganese oxides are depleted, you'll start reducing iron oxide, iron oxyhydroxide minerals. Eventually, you'll get to sulfate, and then deeper in the sediment column, you'll start generating methane, right? You'll have methanogenesis, so you'll have methane coming up through these systems as well. And so in marine systems, I was trained as an oceanographer. In marine systems, we think a lot about sulfur cycling because sulfate is so high in seawater. And so we know a lot about what's happening, say, at the bottom of the ocean with sulfate, but we kind of have overlooked what's happening with sulfate cycling in freshwater environments. That is until, a lot of the talks that we're just focusing on now with sulfate and the impacts on wild rice, of course, it's a big focus. But overall, as a discipline, we've kind of overlooked sulfate as an important process for driving microbial life, driving carbon turnover, carbon degradation, and such processes. So why have we overlooked the role of sulfate? Well, it's because sulfate is in pretty low concentration in most freshwater environments, right? So we just kind of thought, okay, well, we have all these processes. Iron reduction in a lot of environments is probably quite important because there's usually a lot of iron in most environments, and then we kind of skip down to methanogenesis. But as we know, we need to start really thinking about sulfate when it comes to mining waters and taconite mining, where sulfate concentrations are quite high. Someone, I think, mentioned some of the industrial wastewaters as well. So sulfate can be pretty enriched in certain types of industrial wastewaters. And there's an interesting study that came out about 2 years ago by a group in Colorado looking at how sulfate concentrations are increasing again generally across the U.S. It went down for a long period because we were tackling issues like acid rain. And so as acid rain levels went down, right, we saw lower amounts of sulfate in our surface waters, but now we're starting to see that rise again, and a lot of this is being attributed to actually agricultural inputs. So a lot of fertilizers and other things, pesticides, also have sulfates in them. So we're starting to see that increase again. So what does that do for a freshwater environment? And I'm going to, diagram is very complicated, and I will walk you slowly through it so you can kind of understand what's happening. So we now know that we can't really ignore sulfur cycling, and you'll see this, what I refer to as a cryptic sulfur cycle, and it just means hidden. It's hard to see. We've often overlooked the whole cycle, okay? And in general, what you should see is that this sulfur cycle, and I'll go through it in more detail, is connected to iron cycling, okay? So you can kind of think about it as like cogs in a wheel, right? If one is turning this way, and you have cogs and a wheel, they're both gonna turn, right? And so if you have, say, sulfide oxidation, you'll be coupled to iron reduction, for example, or sulfate reduction coupled to methane oxidation, which is another interesting thing, and I'm not gonna really get into that in this talk today, right? But it is coupled to methane cycling, might have important implications for methane emissions. It's coupled to iron cycling. Iron bioavailability is very important. Iron is generally very important for thinking about contaminant sequestration and whatnot. So we definitely want to stop overlooking the sulfur cycle in freshwater environments. Oh, I always push the wrong button. Okay, so let's go. All right, so what are we thinking about then when it comes to, say, northern Minnesota, for example? Well, in northern Minnesota, where we have in certain streams from mining runoff, we might have very high sulfate in surface waters. And so if you think about this sulfur kick, you see this hyperreic flux here. So it might be pushing high sulfate concentrations into the subsurface, right? And so if you have high sulfate and you're in this zone of reduction, right, in anaerobic sediment, and you have sulfate reduction, the sulfate gets reduced to sulfide. And I think Kurt just talked about that. He showed a really nice diagram with the wild rice. And what happens when the sulfide builds up, obviously, is of big concern. But sulfide doesn't always just build up in the environment, in the natural environment. There are a lot of processes that take that sulfide out. So another process could be sulfide then reacts with iron 2+, because if you remember that diagram, iron reduction occurred above the sulfate reduction zone. So all of our iron is reduced now, so we have iron 2+ in our pore waters. And that sulfide then interacts with iron 2+ and precipitates iron sulfide. That's what Chris Schuler saw in his sediments. Iron monosulfide, iron disulfide, things like pyrite. Right? So it can take it out and precipitate it out as a solid. But there's, and that's not the end of the story. We often think of that as the end of the story. But it turns out that sulfide can also be oxidized in a completely anoxic environment. So in the situation that you have sulfide in the presence of iron oxyhydroxides, you can actually oxidize hydrogen sulfide to a whole, I just have it labeled as sulfur intermediates. There are a whole bunch of different sulfur compounds that can form that are represented by these sulfur intermediates. This could be things like elemental or zero valent sulfur. It could be polysulfide, it could be organic or inorganic intermediate valence compounds, thiosulfate, sulfite. There's a whole slew of things that I'm representing here, okay? So this can be oxidized, and then eventually you'll have this sulfur intermediate, which is can be fairly reactive, and it can be then further oxidized to produce sulfate. So basically you're reducing sulfate and then regenerating sulfate in the subsurface. And you're also building up this pool of sulfur intermediates as well. So does this actually happen? Does this whole cryptic cycle actually happen in sediments where we see high sulfate? Well, so we thought out how to determine this, and so we're understanding the biogeochemistry of what's happening in the subsurface, looking for maybe products, some signatures in the sediments, some signatures in the water. Do we see evidence that this cryptic sulfur cycling is actually happening? And what is the influence then, of course, of changes in a dynamic stream system, right? We tend to think of these streams, you know, like surface water penetrating down. Yeah, it might always be a fully inundated stream or a wetland, but as we know, the groundwater direction can change or the magnitude can change quite dramatically. So that might really change this like redox dynamics and the redox gradients in here. So how can we start to tease these apart? Okay, so we started looking at Second Creek, partly because it's been pretty well characterized and pretty well studied. We knew it was an area that had very high sulfate in the surface water. That's around, okay, this is around one, I have 1 to 10 millimolar here, sulfate in the surface water. And in the last presentation, I realized my training and academic mind thinks in molarity. And most people in this room think in ppm or milligrams per liter. So I spent the last 10 minutes redoing calculations on my hand to try to do a quick conversion for you all, because I failed as a professor to heed my own advice to my students of know your audience. So yes, I made all of my graphs in molarity, but I'm gonna do my best to use my cheat sheet on my hand to calculate whether or not, for example, I'm above the 10 ppm limit set by the state of Minnesota. Okay, so going back to Second Creek. Okay, so this creek is fed from the north up here, there's a whole slew of iron operations, iron ore operations up here, and there is discharge from the tailings basins and from the mine pits into Second Creek, which is why there's so much sulfate in the surface water. Okay, and there's also very high iron in this area, not a big surprise, we're on the Iron Range. And there's also one thing to think about is there's very low nitrate in this system, right? So if we think about those terminal electron acceptors and what's gonna be happening in order, oxygen, there's not gonna be very much oxygen because it's gonna be depleted quick. There's not very much nitrogen, but there's a lot of iron and there's a lot of sulfate. Okay, so this was an ideal situation to start thinking about what's happening with cryptic sulfur cycling. Okay, so Let's see. I'm showing just a picture of Second Creek here on the left. And this is a cross-section through Second Creek on the right. This comes from an earlier study by Crystal Ng, where they were looking, many of her collaborators here, they were looking at sort of the groundwater flow through this Second Creek. So Second Creek flows eventually into the Partridge River, but the groundwater, right, it generally moves west to east through this system. And so what we were doing is we were studying these riparian wetlands from a west to east cross-section. So anytime you see my graphs, you'll often see them plotted from left to right, from west to east, okay? And this means that they're plotted through the wetland, and then we sampled what was happening within the stream channel, as well as what's happening in the east wetland, okay? And keeping in mind that there's differences in groundwater flow through this whole system. Okay, there's also a lot of grasses and sedges in these wetlands, lots of organic matter, tons of organic matter in these wetlands, which you would expect, of course. The channel, you know, it has moderate amounts of organic carbon and sparse plants. There is some wild rice growing there. Not very much, but it is there. It's pretty sparse. So we used a number of different approaches to look at what's happening with the hyperreic zone, what's happening with the geochemistry. This is just to show, you know, we monitor surface water through time. We monitor groundwater fluctuations through time. That's, you know, mostly crystals contributions. But we also take cores. We take sediment cores. We extract the sediments to look at the geochemistry, the microbiology. I'm not going to talk about the microbes today. But we extract pore waters using these Rizon samplers, as well as what people, like peepers. I don't know if that means. We call them peepers. I think they're diffusive passive samplers. But basically, you stick these into the sediment, into the muck, right, vertically. And there's all these wells, and you collect... you collect water in here, and it's great because you get this nice spatially resolved water sampling for pore waters, but keep in mind that these are diffusive samplers, so any time I'm showing data, it's kind of averaged over about 2 to 3 weeks time period. These Rizon samplers take what the samples are instantaneously, but they don't have the nice spatial resolution, so we kind of look at these hand in hand. Okay, so just to show you what's happening with the stream over time. So we've done a couple studies on this site, and Crystal's worked on it for many years. But so here we're measuring what the hydraulic head gradient is over the course of 2017 from like May through like November-ish. Okay, and so you can see the hydraulic head gradient plotted. And, you know, anything above zero is upward or a gaining stream system. Anything below zero is a downward fluxing system or a losing system. And what we saw is, it might be a little hard to see. I don't know. The colors aren't super bright here. But what you can see is that in the beginning of the season, it's predominantly gaining, right? It's a predominantly gaining system. It changes a few times. Through here, and then we see this strong downward flux for a while. And we sampled at these points, completely random, in terms of when we sampled. Unfortunately, we missed a lot of these really dynamic seasons where the groundwater is changing direction. It's really hard to know unless you have like telemetry or something where you can monitor what's actually happening live with your stream system. You're just taking a chance of when you go sample. So we did miss most of the changes in flux, but I will say, and I'll point this out now, there were definitely differences in the in some of the geochemistry for this situation here where there had been this long, pronounced downward flux. That's interesting because if there's a long, pronounced downward flux, you're bringing a lot more oxygen and sulfate and everything into your system. So we looked at across the system. So the top one is the west wetland, the central channel, the east wetland. You know, there's subtle differences between the wetlands and the channel, stream channel. Not surprising, there's a lot of differences in the connectivity and everything of these systems. But in general, they had similar trends. The east wetland had a really pronounced downward flux in the fall, which was interesting. And of course, it's responding mostly to the changes in precipitation in the area. Okay, so how does this influence, how do these changes in flux, how do they actually change the geochemistry of the environment? And how does that vary with location, wetland versus stream? And what evidence do we have that there is a cryptic sulfur cycle? So the first data I'm showing is for aqueous pore water iron concentrations. And we speciated the iron. Most people only measure total iron, but we wanted to know if there was actually iron 3 in the pore waters at depth. This was very important because iron 3 is essential for kicking that cycle back upwards, right? Like iron 3 is essential for oxidizing the sulfide back eventually to sulfate. So we took the pore waters and we preserved them in a way to keep the speciation consistent, and we analyzed them. And what you see are, so we have two samples. We took replicates of the west wetland, the channel in the middle, and the east wetland on the right-hand sides. And you can see the dissolved concentrations of iron in millimolar. It's very high. That's very high concentrations. There's a lot of iron in this system. And what you see here is like these little X's represent the surface water. So there's what we would expect in an oxygenated stream water, very low iron, right? It's all been precipitated out. So, but what happens when you get into the channel is, you know, there is some iron deposition. It gets reduced pretty quickly. And so you see iron 2 concentrations, right? It reduces from iron 3 to iron 2. Iron 2 concentrations go up in the channel. They go up. But comparatively, the west wetlands have a lot of iron, right? So this is where most of our iron is. That makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of settling of sediments. There's a lot of mixing of different things in this system. There's a lot of organic matter input, which is also bringing in iron. So there's really high concentrations of total iron in the west and east wetland. They vary with depth, but that's not really the important part. The important part is that there's iron 3 at depth. So in our pore waters, we are seeing the presence of iron 3. So it's this little orange bar that you see, and it might not look like much because the iron concentrations are so high, but that's a decent amount of iron 3 in the pore waters at depth, which means it's probably pretty reactive with sulfide and other things. We have done other studies since and work with some of our other collaborators who do things like cyclic voltammetry. And what we think the iron 3 is, initially we thought maybe it was like some colloidal iron or something, iron oxides going through the pore waters. But what we now are pretty confident is that it's aqueous iron 3 chelated by organics, right? So like humic acids, lots of humic acids in these environments, they're chelating and stabilizing that iron 3, keeping it in solution. Doesn't mean it's totally stable, it can still be reactive, but it's gonna be there a lot longer than, you know, than say an iron oxide mineral. Okay, so that was really important factor for us thinking about the cryptic cycle because we have iron 3 in the pore waters. So do we have it in the sediments? So Chris Schuler already introduced this X-ray absorption spectroscopy technique. We use the exact same technique. And the great thing is you can tune the energy, as he mentioned, to the element that you're interested in. So techniques like X-ray diffraction are not good in this type of environment because there are so many really crystalline minerals and really poorly crystalline minerals, and you're going to completely miss the poorly crystalline minerals, right, or low abundance minerals. So this technique is done at a synchrotron, really high power X-ray source, and we've tuned it to now look just at the energy, or the iron energy, so iron-bearing minerals, and we can get aqueous phases, we can look at, you know, non-crystalline phases. And so here you see everything plotted from the west wetland channel and east wetland over the course of time. So June, July, August, October, okay? And we took sediments at the top of the core, middle of the core, and down towards the bottom of the core. So the things that should jump out at you, okay? So I've plotted these where the dark, the really like blacks and grays, those are our really reduced sulfur. Things like iron monosulfide, macnaite, Chris just mentioned, right? Pyrrhotite, stuff like that. So we see that, not a big surprise. We would expect that, iron monosulfide. It's very reducing. There's a lot of iron. There's a lot of sulfur, okay? But we also see on the left-hand side of all the graphs are these yellowy, orangey colors. Those are our oxidized iron forms. Right? So we also see in the sediments, there's a lot of iron 3 adsorbed, probably a lot of aqueous iron 3 potentially absorbed to the sediment all the way down, right? It doesn't matter what, these are very reducing, right? The sulfate should, or iron 3 should totally be gone in these environments, but they're not, right? So there's a lot of iron 3 at depth in the sediment solid phase, as well as in the aqueous phase. Okay, and the other thing I wanted to point out, right, is that we often see, in, especially in October, in that east wetland where you had that really strong downward fluxing system, you see iron oxides sustained there for quite a while, like solid phase, goethite, ferrihydrite type minerals in the thing, in the sediments. So that was quite exciting to see these changes, because we didn't see a lot of changes throughout the profile. So we were kind of like, there isn't a whole lot changing, but where we see these strong downward gradients, this flip from a, upward flux system to a downward flux system, we definitely see the chemistry responding, even after a couple weeks. So can the cryptic sulfur cycle be sustained coupled to iron reduction? We see a lot of confidence in our iron measurements now. So here we take a look at aqueous sulfate, and this is where my cheat sheet comes in handy, right? Because I have plotted millimolar concentrations. So let's see, we are way above our surface water, which is about like three millimolar sulfate. We're way above the sulfur standard, like sulfate standards for the state. Okay, we're well above that here. All right, so we have high surface waters, and we plotted it with depth, right? Concentration with depth. And you see that sulfate goes to the sediment-water interface right here, and it gets depleted pretty quickly, right? Most systems, it gets depleted very, very quickly down, not to zero, but it gets depleted and stays really, really low, right? So sulfate reduction is happening. It's there. Here in the East Wetland, one of the cool things is that the sulfate was elevated in our peeper samples, right? So after that downward flux, we were still capturing, even after 3 weeks after the system rebounded, we were still capturing, higher sulfate concentrations at depth. So that surface water is really genuinely pushing oxygen, iron, sulfate down into the hyperreic zone, which is really cool to see. So that was really interesting. But the other piece of really key information for interrogating the cryptic sulfur cycle is that sulfates never went to zero. So for a groundwater model, our crystal was always like, I can't figure out how in my models you can get a situation where sulfate never goes to zero. Because sulfate reduction happens, it should go to completion. It shouldn't just stop, right? So we don't think it stops anywhere. What we think is that sulfate gets reduced, but then it's getting reoxidized, right, in this totally anaerobic process, reoxidized to regenerate sulfate at depth. So this is crystal has worked on all these reactive transport models. This is the only way you can get sulfate at depth, really. We've gone through lots of different reactions. How do you get sulfate at depth? You get it by oxidizing sulfide, right, at depth. Okay, so this was a really exciting finding, and we're confident in our numbers, right? We do all of the measurements ourselves, and we look at different systems. We're confident that it's not zero. It looks like zero in this graph because the concentrations are so high, but it's never zero. It's about 200 micromolar sulfate in these systems. So definitely, so it's below the regulation, the sulfate regulation, but, it's not zero. Okay, so sulfide, I was initially going to pull this slide out, but I decided to go with it because people are really interested in, is there sulfide? So we measured sulfide. It's very hard to measure sulfide, I will say that. It's hard to measure accurately. It's very easy to ruin your samples if you're not careful in how you sample it because it can quickly oxidize. But we have methods of doing it. It is possible. You just have to be very careful. And we're confident in our numbers, but our numbers tell us there's very low aqueous sulfide in solution, right? So all that sulfate is being reduced. It's making sulfide, but clearly that sulfide is going to other places, right? We know it's going to iron monosulfide a little bit, and we're pretty sure now that it's going to being reoxidized to sulfate. But what is our other piece of evidence for that? Well, the really interesting thing, and I think this is kind of something that I hope people here are interested in maybe want to talk more about because I love this data right here. So this is, now we're using X-ray absorption spectroscopy to look at the sulfur. So we're only looking at the sulfur pool now. What is sulfur? What forms, what species are there? Okay, and sulfur is super complicated compared to iron. Iron, you have two oxidation states. It's super easy, right? Sulfur, there are like 8 oxidation states, right? Sulfur has an oxidation state of +6. It can be reduced all the way to sulfide. Sulfur is -2. So you have this huge range of all these different redox species and compounds that can form along the way, right? And what we see is a lot of those different species. It's not just sulfide. It's not just iron monosulfide. We see a lot of things that we were really interested in seeing and especially trying to figure out eventually how to explain. Because what you are looking at, here's the west wetland again, the channel, the east wetland, and the relative amount of all these different sulfur compounds that we have identified through X-ray absorption spectroscopy, right? And then our cores from, you know, top to bottom through the different seasons. And, you know, there are more changes compared to the iron speciation, but what I really want to first draw your attention to, the result that we were most interested in, was that there was a ton of this zero valent sulfur form, right? A ton of elemental sulfur, a lot of things like polysulfide. We don't know yet if it's organic polysulfide or inorganic. We don't know. I have these listed as organic intermediate sulfur. We kind of know what species they are. If people want to talk about that more, I can get into it later, but we have a pretty good estimate of what those are, but we know that there's this huge buildup of all these intermediate sulfur forms. Okay, so that was really, really interesting. Are these sediments a giant sink? Have we completely overlooked this huge sulfur pool in the subsurface? Yes, we've completely overlooked it. What does it mean? I don't really know yet. Is it reactive? Is it going to reoxidize? Yes, it can reoxidize. We know that. Sulfur can reoxidize. Sulfur can be reduced. It's not entirely stable, but it is building up in these systems. Okay. The other interesting thing is, we, relative to the amount of iron monosulfide, well, we know we see iron monosulfide in the sediments. And we know about how much iron monosulfide there is in the sediments, and it's a fair amount. And we see that in the iron measurements. But when we look at the sulfur pool, yes, we see a little bit of iron monosulfide, but like, there is so much elemental sulfur and all these these intermediate valent sulfur forms. What is going on? So we have a lot of work to do still to kind of like really understand what's happening, why this is building up. I think it has to do with the amount of organic matter in these systems. There's some studies that are now coming out that show elemental sulfur can be stabilized by and like capped by organic matter, and that might be stabilizing it, but it is still also reactive, right? It can be a terminal electron acceptor, it can be an electron donor, it can oxidize, reduce, right? So it's, you know, what its reactivity is still a big question. Okay, so just to wrap this up, do we see evidence of a cryptic sulfur cycle? Yes, absolutely. We see this in our iron chemistry. We see this in our sulfur chemistry. What's going on with sulfate? Sulfate is being reduced, completely reoxidized in an anoxic environment to produce a lot of this, the sulfur intermediate, and eventually some of this sulfate is being regenerated, right? So it just keeps cycling like this. And eventually you might have this kick-in of excess sulfate coming in through the hyperreic zone. What is the fate of all these sulfur compounds? I think we still need to do a lot of work to interrogate this. How do the rates matter? Does really high sulfate make a really high sulfur cycling rate? We need to get at the rates. That we're working on that right now in the lab to try to figure this out. So that's kind of, you know, it answers a lot of things and it brings up a lot of really interesting observations, but it still leaves us with a lot of questions about what's happening. So how does the hydrogeology connect to all of this? Well, we see changes with the hydrogeology, but now we really need to build these reactive transport models to put in cryptic sulfur cycling. So that is what Crystal and some of her graduate students are doing right now. We're telling them which reactions are the most important based on some of the chemistry data you see, some of the microbiology data that I didn't show. But this should probably give us some better insight into what's happening and what's possible with sulfur cycling in these sediments. So stay tuned. Thanks for your attention, and I'm happy to answer questions.
My wife and I go to visit Second Creek once in a while, and it's a nice little creek coming in there. Of course, we don't have access to mining company property anymore, but we see there's almost always a good current coming through those culverts right next to the Partridge River. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of wondering, maybe I missed it in your slides, is most of that coming off of mine pits and tailings ponds, or some of that the natural watershed that's feeding into that good water flow?
Well, someone in this room probably could answer that better than I can. There is a good water flow. We sample right probably where you're talking about. We sample right before the confluence of the Partridge River. And there's a lot of water moving through there. I do know that, it's a natural stream, right? So there's a lot of water moving naturally through there. But they do, and maybe somebody else can answer this, they do discharge surface water from some of the mine pits through here. So it could potentially increase. I don't know how much it increases the water flow, but it moves quickly through that system.
Yeah, you showed a strong downward flux in mid to late September in your graph. I was trying to see, did you plot the hydrograph of the stream and then also rainfall on the same scale?
I don't think Crystal plotted it on the same scale.
Well, I see precip there on D.
Yep, you see it at the same time scale. Is that what you're wondering, the same time scale? It's the exact same time scale.
Well, I guess my question is, did you examine what caused that strong downward flux at that time period?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Crystal says that it's probably due to increased precipitation through this time period, although it's interesting to me that, not being a hydrogeologist, that a lot of the precipitation happens just after we see this switch to a downward flux. But it is all calibrated, and, how we see this huge increase in precipitation following this, downward flux, I'm not entirely sure. Maybe you can explain that to me. I do the chemistry and the microbes. I know how to interpret these graphs.
Very interesting work. Thank you. Just two quick questions. Is I see this data is 2017. Have you added any additional years of monitoring? And just I'll get a couple of them out and I'll let you answer them however it makes sense. And then also, do you have a control site of non-heavily sulfate influenced waters? And how do those compare with that sulfur speciation that you see in the sediments?
Yeah, both great questions. So Crystal worked at this site a few years prior to this study, and we do have a couple years worth of data, and we do see very similar trends where it changes, but maybe not quite as dramatically in terms of the flux. So it does change. It changes, vertically, right? It'll change from losing to gaining, but maybe not quite as distinct as what we saw here in this 2017. We saw this very pronounced downward flux. And, there was a lot of precipitation at that time, so maybe that was why. We haven't followed it since. We're working on other systems. We haven't followed it since, partly because our partners, so we now work a lot on wild rice, and we are guided by our tribal partners, and our tribal partners have asked us to not focus on this site anymore because it's so well studied, and they want to think about what is happening in other systems, other river systems, other lake systems, especially where you have maybe not quite as high of sulfate, but you have other factors like damming of lakes and stuff like that. So we haven't followed up specifically on this site. I'd love to get back there at some point to start monitoring and seeing how, if you know, if the geochemistry is changing at all, how it might be changing. So that's to answer that question. Do we have a comparison site with low sulfate? Yes, we don't have it necessarily. Well, we do have another site on the Iron Range. It still has, you know, higher sulfate than like a, you know, totally unimpacted sulfur stream system, but it's not nearly as high as Second Creek. That study, the results show that there is also this huge buildup of, and it's quite similar in terms of the sulfur intermediates that we see, right? So we see a fair amount of iron monosulfide, but then we see all this like elemental sulfur and stuff like that. We also study, we have another study site in South Carolina where I just got back from the field, and in that system we have very low sulfate. So like something like, I don't know, 30 micromolar as opposed to like, you know, millimolar concentrations that we're seeing at Second Creek. And again, we see very similar trends where most of the sulfur pool is actually not iron monosulfide or some other form. It's actually these the specific types of intermediate valence sulfur varies depending on whether you're in this Second Creek system or this really low sulfate system, but it's mostly elemental sulfur, polysulfide, thiosulfate, sulfite, and a few of these organic intermediate sulfur forms. So yes, it is consistent. Now that we know how to look for them and that we should be looking for them, but it's not easy to identify, right? There's a reason we haven't been studying a lot of this before. It's not easy. These techniques are not accessible to a lot of people. So, you know, it's not an easy thing to interrogate.
Yeah, I find it fascinating that you're finding so much elemental sulfur because, you know, the iron sulfides are so stable under any, at least low DO conditions and almost any pH, to just physically precipitate zero valent sulfur, you generally need to have a pH below 6 and just the right redox. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, you know, what kind of redox conditions you had and what pH did you have in the sediments in those zones where you think you were creating elemental sulfur?
Yeah, well, we see it throughout the whole column, right? But the pH is about right. The pH is just, you know, it's like around 6-ish, right? And there might be some variation, but, you know, in general, the pH is about right. Is it just elemental sulfur? So this is a question that I have and something we need to really figure out a little bit more, because when you oxidize, I don't have the full cycle drawn. Maybe I can find a different one. Okay, so when you oxidize hydrogen sulfide to produce like elemental sulfur, usually, in some cases, it's not just producing elemental sulfur, it's producing what we call polysulfide. And polysulfide can be a huge chain of elemental sulfurs with sulfides at the end, right? So even though our Zane spectra, we can sort of distinguish between polysulfide and elemental sulfur. It's a little tight in there, so I'm not 100% confident that it's, you know, there's elemental sulfur. There's zero valent sulfur. Whether it's like the type of sulfur that I think you might be thinking about, like the yellow glot, you know, like when you produce these like ore bodies of like, you know, I think of Italy and the incredible sulfur, you know, ore bodies that they have. It's like bright yellow mineral samples. Is it that type of elemental sulfur? I'm not really thinking it is. I think it looks quite different than that, and it might be actual chains of elemental sulfur with some like sulfides at the end of it. So we'd like to figure out how to distinguish those, and there are some techniques that we can use to really get at that. But it should be there. I mean, in terms of the chemistry, we should expect to see it there, and we do.
Thanks, Kara. This is really, really interesting, of course. One of the questions I have with respect to the reactive transport modeling that you alluded to, that you're working on, and then, frankly, the in quantifying that, what you said is that huge sulfur pool, or maybe unexpectedly huge sulfur pool. What do you assume for the groundwater that's like being conveyed to the channel during the gaining conditions? You know, you had your timeline up there showing, you know, a few weeks or maybe a month of like downward gradient, but in reality, like the whole winter, you're probably getting groundwater inflow as a gaining stream, and the entire other time it's a gaining stream. So how do you account for sulfur that comes? Because background sulfur on the range in groundwater is something like 10 to 30 milligrams per liter. So there's a lot of sulfate being transported at all times to that system through groundwater.
Yeah, we did think about that. And, you know, when it comes into contact with, you know, when it comes into the hyporheic zone, is it still sulfates? I would not expect it to be sulfate, right? I would expect it to be sulfide at that point. The conditions there are so reducing, there's just so much organic matter that it's going to get reduced pretty quickly. So that means there's some sulfide coming in also. So we do want to think about what that input might look like from the bottom up. And Crystal is thinking about like what happens if you get maybe sulfide from the bottom, from the groundwater coming up, or sulfate coming in. You know, the flux is vertical, but it's also coming in from the side in the system, right? So you have some complicating factors. And she does consider that in her models, sort of this directional flow and the inputs and outputs. And, one of the things she told me is that, like, no matter what's coming in, it's being reduced pretty quickly, right? In this system, it's reduced very, very quickly. And we see that in our sediment profiles. I mean, even when you look at sulfate concentrations, right, in, say, May or June, right, when you had that long, prolonged downward flux, upward flux, sulfate concentrations here in red, right, they're being reduced, like, and through the, like, down to 50 centimeters depth. It's just really, like, there's no sulfide, and there's, like, very low sulfate. It's very consistent. But we never really see a peak at depth either of sulfate. So we never see evidence that sulfate comes in up from the bottom far enough to influence sort of this package. Yeah, and would we have to sample earlier in the season to see that? Or in a different part of the system?
Well, just like, I don't know, to know like what you should assume for like incoming sulfate.
Right. Yeah, we have groundwater wells that we have. So we have values for all of our numbers. And Crystal, that's how we knew that the water, that's how Crystal knew. And I think Scott may have been involved in all of that, Scott Alexander, to figure out where the water was moving from. And, you know, there's a bunch of groundwater wells upstream of that. So we know what the water is before it comes in and, you know, before it enters, like, the Partridge River, for example. Yep. And that's all incorporated into the model.
Thank you.